Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's episode of Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. My guests for this hour are firstly Dr. Monica Miller, who's no stranger to this program, pro-life champion and warrior, and she has just learned that the Department of Justice has begun legal proceedings against her and Citizens for Pro-Life Society. She joins us to not only continue the story, but also to let us know how we can aid in the process, and most of all, how we can pray towards a more just society wherein the life of the unborn is not seen as a negotiable reality, but is in fact a gift given by the omnipotent God that possesses the dignity of the divine image. Contrary to these recent cases wherein judges have been stating things to the effect of how abortion is not deemed as causing harm because the life of the unborn isn't deemed as deserving or isn't deemed as viable life, isn't deemed as life. And so at that point, only the rights of the mother are being considered. In the face of all of this, Dr. Monica Miller is at the forefront, fighting for the rights of the unborn, and most of all, fighting for a pro-life society, a more just legal system that will enable us to be able to take this fight, not just to the level of the state, but eventually to make abortion unthinkable. And then in the second and third segment of today's program, we will be talking with Bruce Green about the new book that they've just put out by Ignatius Press entitled Making Moral Decisions at the End of Life. St. Robert Bellarmine writes that a person may be compelled when unprepared to and oppressed by disease and scarcely possessed of reason, to give an account of those things on which, when in health, he had perhaps once never reflected. The fact of the matter is, the heat of the battle is the wrong time to make decisions. And so what this book enables us to do is to calculate many of the issues that arise towards the end of a person's life, and to be able to ask those questions about what end-of-life decisions look like. And it addresses things like what palliative care really means, what hospice really means, and most of all, what the church teaches, what divine revelation tells us about the dignity of the human person and what it means to live and to die well. So I want to invite you to stay tuned. We have an intriguing hour ahead of us. For now, let's take a look at the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, June 4th. It's the Feast of St. Petroc. Today's news brought to you by Ave Maria University. Your vocation location is at avemaria.edu. President Biden has signed an executive order to limit the flow of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border. In remarks from the White House, Biden said he made the decision after Congress failed to pass a bipartisan border bill earlier this year.
We came to a clear bipartisan deal. It was the strongest border security agreement in decades. But then Republicans in Congress, not all, but walked away from it. Why? Because Donald Trump told them to.
House Speaker Mike Johnson telling reporters one executive order will not solve the migrant crisis.
Because it will extend once again the welcome mat. Incentivize people to come and be among the first 2,500 is what we're hearing. The first 2,500 per day to come in. To be ensured that you get your welcome package when you come into the country illegally. It's absolute madness.
The move will prohibit migrants who cross the U.S.-Mexico border illegally from requesting asylum once the number of daily encounters tops 2,500 between official ports of entry. And polling has shown that most Americans disapprove of Biden's handling of the immigration as border crossings surge. A Hong Kong cardinal is marking the anniversary of Tiananmen Square's massacre by urging Christians in China to learn to proactively forgive and move beyond finger-pointing. In a May 30th reflection, Cardinal Stephen Chow wrote that the 1989 massacre of innocent protesters remains a sore spot that requires attention for healing, but that his faith prompts him to forgive whoever and whatever. And more than 6 in 10 Americans will have cardiovascular disease by 2050. That according to a new American Heart Association report. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. Last week, Dr. Monica Miller learned that the Department of Justice has begun legal proceedings against her and her nonprofit, Citizens for a Pro-Life Society. She joins us to continue the story. So, Monica, last week when we talked about the 9 pro-lifers
right.
who are being sentenced, but we didn't have enough time to address what you've been going through. So, last week when you and I spoke, essentially a bomb was dropped, and we really do need to discuss this because this is a precedent-setting problem
yes.
if it's not addressed.
Right. Actually, I think it would be 3 weeks ago today. The United States Department of Justice issued a complaint against myself, 6 other pro-lifers, including Father Fidelius Mushensky, Citizens for a Pro-Life Society, and Red Rose Rescue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're bringing this lawsuit under the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act in a 40-page complaint and alleging that Red Rose Rescues, and in particular the 2, they're only focusing, it's very odd what's going on here, actually. They're only focusing on the 2 rescues that we did in Ohio back in June. In fact, today is the anniversary of the first one, June 4th, 2021. And they're alleging that these rescues, Red Rose, these 2 Red Rose rescues violated the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act. Now, this is only, quote unquote, a civil suit.
Mm-hmm.
They are not bringing this under the criminal charge.
That's right.
Which, by the way, already tells us they know they are in a weaker position.
Right.
Because they don't need as much weight in terms of the evidence to get a conviction in a civil case
mm-hmm.
as they would in a criminal case. We feel confident that we have a very, very good chance of prevailing. Why? Listen, folks, Red Rose Rescues do not engage in physical obstruction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key term. We don't use any force, intimidation, or physical obstruction, which is the language of the FACE Act.
That's right.
And what does it mean in terms of interference? Interference in the FACE Act means that you have done something to physically prevent another person's freedom of movement. Red Rose Rescues don't do that.
Yeah.
But they're trying their best to stuff, okay, to contrive, to distort our activity in these 2 particular rescues to come under the FACE Act. This is this is probably one of the most important lawsuits to come along, perhaps in decades.
Mm-hmm.
If the Department of Justice prevails against us, every single federal court in the United States will be weaponized to go after pro-lifers. So that could include sidewalk counselors,
right.
Protesters outside of abortion centers who might stand in a driveway or you walk up to it. In fact, I'm being accused of not letting a woman out of her car. And when we did this rescue on June 5th at the Planned Parenthood in Bedford Heights, Ohio, we were only on the parking lot. We never entered the abortion center.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what we were doing was sidewalk counseling, but on this massive parking lot, okay, which means that these moms pull in and they go in the back part of the parking lot, totally inaccessible to sidewalk counselors. So this was our opportunity to really have the deeper, fuller engagement with them by going onto the parking lot. So I walk up to a car and a woman rolls down her window and I'm having a conversation with her. I'm trying to give her a pamphlet. And that's supposedly the obstruction.
Mm-hmm.
You see how things are going here, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, and this thing, it's kind of interesting too that the Department of Justice, sometimes I prefer to call it the Department of Injustice, but saw fit to issue this complaint right in the middle of the sentencings
yeah.
for the 9 pro-lifers who indeed did, you know, block doors and prevented the abortions by standing in front of the doors.
Okay. Right. Traditional rescues.
Right. And they anticipated they were going to get charged with the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances mm-hmm. Act. Maybe going back a little bit here to review what nobody ever expected in that particular rescue, which was at this abortion center in Washington, D.C., Cesar Sant'Angelo, does abortions on demand through the 9th month of pregnancy. I am not kidding. Nobody expected, this was a 2020 rescue, that these 9 rescuers would also be charged with conspiracy to interfere with civil rights. It's never happened in the history of legalized abortion.
Right, exactly.
That has a 10-year jail term attached to it, maximum.
Mm-hmm.
So now, okay, so now all the sentencings are finished, but that there's no way that that was just an accident, you know. So they're doubling down
yep.
and coming after Red Rose rescuers. And I want your listeners to understand, you know, if you do a Red Rose rescue, we cap the presence of the pro-lifers as no more than 6.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, anywhere from 2 to 6 pro-lifers. Enter the waiting room of an abortion center. Try to sit down quietly next to the moms who are scheduled for, you know, to kill their children. This is the last opportunity that we have to help them choose life.
Mm-hmm.
And we have had women leave. We've had women take roses and a boyfriend, and people have left. So we know that there have been successes. But we don't obstruct anything, you know, but like I said, the Department of Justice is obsessed with going after pro-lifers, and now we've been swept into their persecution, you know, prosecution, right now, the Thomas More Society in Chicago is defending myself and Lauren Handy, because we were the only two that were arrested at the particular rescue
mm-hmm.
on June 5th of 2021. And then Life Legal Defense is also taking some of the other defendants.
Right.
And so we're in the very, very beginning stages of responding to the complaint. And I anticipate that sometime later this year we'll be going to court.
Yeah. Well, in the face of all of this, as our listeners are listening, we're really seeing true miscarriages of justice here. And like you mentioned, the Department of Injustice, and it is no coincidence, no coincidence that the timing of these allegations being brought against you and the involvement of the DOJ in the sentencing of those 9 pro-lifers.
Right.
In fact, when you told me that, was the first thing that came to my mind. This cannot be a coincidence. So we're seeing an unprecedented legal crackdown.
Well, and here's in some ways, the irony of the situation. Red Rose rescues were crafted to avoid mm-hmm. violating the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act. And there have been 37 Red Rose rescues since 2017. 5 of them in Michigan, where I live, okay? And not once have we ever been charged with the FACE Act.
Mm-hmm.
So that right there shows you that the judicial system has not recognized, has not seen the activity of a Red Rose rescue as a FACE violation.
That's right.
So put that in our column, right? You get charged with a trespassing city ticket or a Class C or Class B misdemeanor of trespassing or whatever. And it's been pretty amazing. We've had Red Rose rescues where literally no charges were filed. We've had Red Rose rescues where charges were dismissed, and a couple of Red Rose rescues where we had not guilty verdicts.
Mm-hmm.
So it's gone all the way from 0 to the maximum 90 days.
Uh-huh.
So that's been it for Red Rose rescues.
So for everyone listening right now, they want to know how they can stand with you, how they can get involved.
Well, they can go to the website, redroserescue.com, super simple, redroserescue.com. We will have updates on that website. Also, my website for Citizens for a Pro-Life Society is simple, pro-life, no hyphen, prolifesociety.com. We're right now posting, mounting new postings regarding my articles that I wrote regarding the sentencings. I had one yesterday in Crisis Magazine. And then what's going on with the new lawsuit. So probably by tomorrow, prolifesociety.com will be updated.
Okay. And so where do you go from here now? You're beginning the early stages. What's happening? What are some of the procedures that you're involved in?
Well, collecting evidence on our side. We still have two pro-lifers who are without counsel. So we're trying to put out requests to various attorneys for them, and I think we're in a good position. For example, in the rescue that we did at the Planned Parenthood in Bedford Heights, Ohio, Lauren Handy literally sat down on the pavement of the parking lot, 10 feet away from the door.
Mm-hmm.
There are photographs of that. There are video of that. How does that violate the freedom of access
That's
to
right.
Okay, you see my point, right? So we're going to fight this as hard as we possibly can. But I don't take anything for granted, and I really want people to put this on their prayer list. Offer masses, do novenas, say your prayers, rosaries, holy hours, because we absolutely have to beat this.
Yeah, I completely agree. And like you mentioned, I think one of the concerns is that this is probably going to be precedent setting.
Yes.
If they come after you, they can come after every pro-life apostolate in the
right.
country.
Right, because if they can find a way to broaden the definition of physical obstruction or interference, then it's open season. I mean, at that point, they'll be emboldened by this press, their victory to go after other pro-lifers.
Yep. Thank you so much for joining us, Monica.
Yeah.
We will continue in our prayers. All of the links of these articles and your websites will be in the description of today's program. And if any of you would like to reach out to you very quickly.
ProLifeSociety.com has a contact tab, and you can email us right through there.
Perfect. Thank you, Monica. My guest is Dr. Monica Miller, Director of Citizens for Pro-Life Society. She teaches theology at Sacred Heart Major Seminary and is a prolific author. Please get involved in her work and stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the Afternoon.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
St. Gregory of Nazianzus once said, "He who does acts of mercy should do so with cheerfulness. The grace of a good deed is doubled when it's done with promptness and speed." The best way most of us can learn this approach to Christian service is in our family lives. That's why prompt, generous, consistent, and cheerful attention to each other's needs is such an important part of the liturgy of domestic church life. Every day, ask each other this life-changing question. What's one small thing each of us can do to make each other's lives a little easier or more pleasant? Then, remember to do those things as a way of letting God's love shine out through you in your family. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
John 6, verses 48 to 58. Jesus says, "I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and they died. This is the bread," meaning me. "This is the bread which comes down from heaven that a man may eat of it and never die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread which I shall give for the life of the world is my flesh. at which the Jews disputed among themselves, saying, "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" They're scandalized by this. How is it that we're not? How is it that we just hear this and go, "Oh yeah, I know that passage"? They're just outraged and at least perplexed. Sane people, inspired teachers, wise men, prophets don't say things like this.
Hi, this is Father Mike Schmitz. Please join me for Ascension's Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year here on EWTN Radio. We're going through the entire Bible and the Catechism in 365 days. If you've ever wanted to understand what it means to be Catholic and allow those truths to shape your life, this is for you.
Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz. Tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific on EWTN Radio.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. St. Robert Bellarmine writes that a person may be compelled when unprepared, oppressed by disease, and scarcely possessed of reason, to give an account of those things on which, when in health, he had perhaps never once reflected. Simply put, he's effectively saying that when we are faced with moral crises, especially when in sickness and in death, the moral obligation of our decisions is still upon us. We still have the onus of sound moral decision-making. This is the foundation of Bruce Green's new book, Now and at the Hour of Our Death, Making Moral Decisions at the End of Life. Bruce joins us. Bruce is a former constitutional and pro-life litigator, dean, and law professor. He serves as special counsel to the Bioethics Defense Fund and is a regular speaker and teacher in Catholic parishes. He is a lay member of the Order of Preachers, OP. Bruce, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Marcus. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you.
I found this book to be truly enlightening for the reason that it presents all of these questions of life and death issues in a question and answer format. It's pretty succinct. It's very approachable. And on the one hand, I want to say thank you for penning it this way. But secondly, you touch on this in your introduction. What was it that prompted writing the book in this format?
Well, the first thing that I want to mention will explain a little bit of that. I'm actually a co-author of the book. Mm-hmm. My co-author is Nicholas Nickus. He is the president and general counsel for the Bioethics Defense Fund. And it was Nick's idea initially to approach this in a question and answer format. I was a little bit unconvinced initially, but it turned out to be a great way to do it. We wanted to make it very accessible to the average layperson dealing with complex issues, yet breaking them down in a way that was easy to understand. So, while it's not a catechism, it certainly follows more of that question and answer approach in order to be accessible. As far as why we wrote the book, there are a number of reasons that we set forth in the book, at least four that we mentioned. One of them is that modern technology and medical advancements have resulted in the ability to sustain and extend life far beyond what was possible just a few generations ago.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith said is that that raises moral problems, and so there are moral questions that arise because of this. Another reason that we sought to make this accessible and clear and write the book is that modern man's formation has not really kept up with the technological progress and of the medical interventions. What we mean by this is that our formation, our understanding of the moral requirements of God's law and how it is applied in concrete circumstances, especially medical circumstances, really hasn't kept up with the pace of these technological advancements. So our formation is not quite what it ought to be.
Right.
Another reason that we mention is that that people simply aren't familiar with the everyday challenges posed by the medical advancements. So all of these together, along with the fact that there were just a number of specific issues that need to be addressed, were the reasons we wrote the book.
Right. And Bruce, I want to just touch on that penultimate point you just made. You're completely right that in terms of formation, there's still a lot to do. The church is wanting for many other people to rise up and continue the work of formation. But like you highlight in your book, we want our listeners to be aware of the fact that the principles of morality that govern moral decision-making, they're perennial, and the church has always put them forth. And so in your book, for example, you highlight the applications of those core principles, which we're very grateful for. But we also want everyone to be clear that the church has always taught these perennial truths, and Bruce and Nick here attempt to apply them to the advances of modern technology. So to that end, I want to begin by asking the question of what does it mean to make an end-of-life decision?
Well, one of the things that we mentioned in the book is that there's not a specific definition with respect to what the end of life means. But basically, it's a term that that is used to indicate that the decisions that are being addressed are decisions by a person that will likely to die soon, or their caregivers are called upon to make decisions regarding healthcare needs or medical treatment for a person whose life will not last very long. So they're in the end stage of their life.
Right. So moving forward from there, then, talking about the end stage and especially talking about death, one of the things you highlight in this book, which seems to be a problem, is what is the definition of death? Now, the church has a formal definition, but medical science has a problem determining what that point really is.
That's true. One of the reasons that we have a section in the book that deals with the question of what is death is the very thing that you mentioned. What we say in there is that the best understanding of it is a theological understanding, and that is death occurs when the soul leaves the body. As Pope John Paul II said, however, is that there is no medically, scientifically verifiable way to see the soul leaving the body. And
that's
so
right.
As a result, there have been tests that have been developed, medical tests to make a determination as to when death occurs. One is the cardiopulmonary, with which we're most familiar. The person's organs fail, their breathing stops, their heart stops, and it's the one we're most familiar with. Before long, the process of decay sets in. The other and relatively new approach that is used is what is called brain death, and that is the total and complete cessation of the brain. And that is actually more recent, but there are these ways of determining it. But still, it doesn't change the fact that death occurs when the soul leaves the body and not before.
Right, exactly. And so could one argue, as you do in the book, that there are cases where one could determine the cardiopulmonary criteria and yet still not have a case where death has actually taken place?
Yes, in fact, that's the that is precisely the concern, that there may be circumstances where a person may be resuscitated, revived, or in a state, comatose state for a lengthy period of time, and yet there may be a medical determination that there have been no viable signs of life of the brain and determine that they're dead, when in reality they return from such circumstances on occasion and were not indeed dead.
Right. And now the flip side is also true. There are significant moral problems with utilizing just the neurological criteria as the definition of death.
Yes. One of the things that we mention in the book is that there's some difficulties with establishing the neurological criteria and determining that brain death has actually occurred. So there is the possibility that decision could be made too quickly.
Right, exactly. So given those scenarios, then, while it is difficult, is there a rational, reasonable approach to determining what one would consider is death?
From a medical perspective, yes, the cardiopulmonary, there are simply no questions about the fact of death occurring using cardiopulmonary criteria.
Mm-hmm.
It's long established. There are no controversies or questions in that regard. And so that method itself has a long history, and there have been no significant concerns with that. So it is a way that has been established for time immemorial, and no real controversies arrive with the cardiopulmonary approach.
Right. So then building from there, just talking about these definitions of death and even reading through the questions that your book proposes as we're coming toward the end of this segment, why is it crucial for us to start weighing these questions long before we have to face them?
The reason for that, and you touched on this somewhat with your introduction and Cardinal Bellarmine's quote, the fact is that as life goes on and we face a serious illness, we age, our intellectual powers, our powers of reasoning and working through important moral decisions are often not at their peak. And it's possible under circumstances where we face serious illness that at the time when we're not our strongest, we may be called upon to make serious decisions. So it's important to think through these issues, mm-hmm. to understand the requirements that the church has given us, and to make decisions regarding these things as early as possible, when our mind is as sharp as it can be and we're not under such stress as the end of life. So it's
right.
important for us to make them early.
And it's also important, just flowing from that, to have those relevant discussions with family members and whoever acts as your medical agent, and to make your determination of medical decisions in case you can't.
That's right, because often it will be a family member,
mm-hmm.
and they need to understand our wishes, the teachings of the church, and these issues, as well as a person who is facing this illness.
So we're coming down to the end of this segment, Bruce, and we're going to continue on the other side. My guest is Bruce Green, co-author of Now and at the Hour of Our Death, Making Moral Decisions at the End of Life. former constitutional law professor and serves as special counsel to the Bioethics Defense Fund. Stay tuned as we continue this conversation of making end-of-life decisions. For Crest in the Afternoon, I'm Marcus Peter.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart-friendly, ride-your-bike-everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort-style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at avemaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
A conversation I had several years ago with one of our listeners who wrote to me and said she was being challenged by a friend or a cousin or someone regarding the church and various teachings, especially on marriage and abortion and whatnot. And she said, I need the answers and I need them quickly because I want to quiet this person and shut them down. And I wrote her back and I said, I'm not going to give you the answers. I will give you some resources, such as the link to the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And I said, but you need to look these up and you need to read them over and you need to learn them, because this is not going to be the last time that you're going to be challenged or questioned about your faith. And what good is it if you're just barking answers to someone and you're not able to explain them charitably? This is a way we all should learn, by doing the work ourselves.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern. On EWTN Radio.
How does one describe Christ's relationship to his church? The Catholic Catechism says Christ is one with his church. He is the head, we are the members. Head and members together make up the whole body of Christ. Head and members form, as it were, one and the same mystical person. St. Joan of Arc put it very simply to her judges. She said, about Jesus Christ and the church, I simply know they're just one thing. We shouldn't complicate the matter. The Catechism also refers to the imagery of the bridegroom, the theme of Christ as the bridegroom of the church, as two in one relationship. Just as in marriage, two become one flesh, the church is portrayed as the spotless bride of the spotless Lamb. Christ has joined the church with himself in an everlasting covenant. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest is Bruce Green, co-author of Now and at the Hour of Our Death, Making Moral Decisions at the End of Life. He's a former constitutional law professor and serves as special counsel to the Bioethics Defense Fund. Now, he co-authored this book with Nicholas Nickus, who is the president and general counsel of Bioethics Defense Fund. So, Bruce, we were talking earlier about the understanding of what the church teaches about death, and in preparing for it, in reading things like your book, for example, to have those necessary conversations with friends and family. What are some of the ways in which every individual adult ought to start preparing legally for end-of-life decisions, especially when they're healthy?
You know, one of the things that we do in the book is toward the end of the book, we have several appendices, and we have an appendices on a number of the steps that can be followed in preparation for the end of life. And although it's not, the book is not a book about legal advice, it does give a number of different recommendations. There are several things that that a person can do in preparation. Number one, they can understand better their faith as it relates to the question of suffering. Because at the end of life, we may be facing suffering, and often that will be the case. So we can strengthen our Catholic faith. Another thing that we can do is we can provide for our instructions for our future care that is consistent with the teachings of the Church. There are a number of ways that this can be done through advanced directives. We mentioned that in our book, a medical power of attorney, a healthcare proxy. Those kinds of preparations can be made as well to make sure that our wishes are followed and that the teachings of the Church are followed as well. And there are documents that can be developed, end-of-life documents, in preparation for that.
Right. And reading your book, especially going through the appendices, will give us those guidelines in order to pursue those things well, and making those end-of-life decisions, declaring your medical agent. Now, I want to step back into talking about some of the big picture questions that you answer, that you seek to answer in your book. The first is the question about happiness. Why is happiness such a big factor in making moral decisions, and especially end-of-life moral decisions?
One of the things that we say about the book is that it is really not about death or dying as a morbid experience. Fundamentally, the book is about happiness. Mm-hmm. And it is about happiness not only now in the making of good decisions, but happiness at the hour of our death. One of the things that that we mentioned is that our ultimate end is the purpose for which we live. All Christians should be concerned with reaching our ultimate end, that is our life in God.
Right.
So the decisions that we make in this life can either bring us closer to that ultimate end or take us farther away. And making moral decisions at the end of life can, if we make the wrong ones, actually bring about a danger to our souls. So the book really focuses on how to make good moral decisions that lead to happiness in this life right now and in preparation for the life to come, to take us on our way to God, our ultimate happiness.
So moving on from there then, to talk about happiness with regard to, quote-unquote, dying with dignity. This is one of those euphemisms that's thrown around, especially in the modern sphere, very often, that why can't people be allowed to choose how they want to die, quote-unquote, with dignity? But very often, those solutions or alternatives that are provided don't correspond to man's ultimate happiness in God.
You know, there are a number of these kinds of things that we deal with in the book, and we deal with them in a section called hindrances to making moral decisions at mm-hmm. the end of life. One of those is a number of the typical kinds of things that you mentioned, the euphemisms like dying or death with dignity, which typically in this day and age means a person making an autonomous decision to control their own life and make their own determination as to when they die. What we have mentioned in the book and gone into in some detail is that this is a misunderstanding, not only of dignity, but of autonomy, that man is not autonomous. He's not free to make their own decisions entirely, and that a death with dignity is a death where a person reaches the end of a full and complete life. They have lived their life well. They've made moral decisions, and they are on their way to their ultimate happiness in God.
Mm-hmm. So then touching more on those euphemisms, dying with dignity is one of those things that's thrown around. The other one is bodily autonomy, which is one of the great battle cries of modernity in terms of a revolt against its creator. I have the autonomy to do what I want with my body. But it really is, it flies in the face of even natural law ethics.
Yes, the idea that we are our own determiner, that we are the lord of our own life, that we make all our own decisions and we direct our own fate, is not at all a Christian Catholic view. In fact, it's manifestly contrary to the teaching of the faith, and is really an idea that comes from Benedict XVI's comments regarding that we are in an age of relativism.
That's right.
It's a determination that a person is completely in control of their own life, when in fact they aren't.
And that relativism then segues into, in that same segment of the book that you're talking about, the whole question of morality and conscience. We are often faced with this notion as if I just have to follow my conscience, as if the conscience was dictated by the passions. But you touch on the fact that even when faced with end-of-life decisions, one has an obligation to follow one's conscience to the pursuit of objective truth.
Yes. This is one of the areas that we believe is in need of much more formation in the church today. That more time needs to be spent explaining to Catholics that there is a duty to follow one's conscience, but there is a duty also to make certain that the conscience is properly formed.
Mm-hmm.
And a person who has an ill-formed, improperly formed conscience is very likely to follow their own sense of autonomy or make their own determinations contrary to the teaching of the faith, and in fact then conscience can lead them astray. One of the things that people often think is that if they simply believe in their heart what is right, they're free to follow it, and in fact they are responsible to follow truth and to form their conscience according to truth.
Right, exactly. And I think it's one of those things that we take for granted, as if conscience is this inherently preformed notion in the soul, when as a matter of fact, we have an obligation to pursue truth for the sake of truth, and that informs our consciences to order us towards the desire for and the choosing of the good, and in this case, in the good and the morally good in terms of end-of-life decisions.
Yes, and it's also important to point out that conscience is not infallible. We often think that because we have a duty to follow the conscience, it must be infallible, whatever our conscience tells us to do. The fact of the matter is that our conscience can make mistakes. It's just like any other human judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Since conscience is an act of judgment, it is possible also to set it aside. Someone can have a conscience, even a properly formed conscience, and simply not follow it. They can set it aside. We give an example in the book that the natural law is written on every man's conscience,
mm-hmm.
telling him that murder is wrong, but men do lay aside that common judgment and they commit murder. So it's very important not only that we form our conscience correctly, but that we have a right view about conscience, and that is that it is possible to make mistakes, And we must make sure that it is guided by truth, and certainly the teachings of the church guide us in that respect.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some of the specific applications of some of these principles you've been talking about. When a doctor says that, or when a hospital says that, it has a futility of care policy, that flies in the face of objective morality and moral good.
Yes. The fact of the matter is that the care for a person in late stages of illness or approaching death is never futile.
Mm-hmm.
The church is very clear with regard to its teaching in these circumstances. So even the use of such a term, the futility of care, is not a term that any Catholic should ever use. And it should be the first clue when we're approached with a document or a statement that care is futile, that it is not in keeping with the teaching of the church. The care of a person is never futile. There's always a proper way, a moral way to treat a person in the last stages of illness or approaching death.
Mm-hmm. So in the face of that, when some doctors propose that withholding food and water, withholding nourishment and water, is a medical decision, the fact of the matter is it isn't. It's a basic need of the human person.
That's exactly right. And it is often termed, and we use illustrations of this in the book, it's termed as a medical decision. The reason it's termed that way, Marcus, is that a doctor in their professional duties, they are required to provide all medical treatment consistent with their professional medical judgment. So if it's classified as medical treatment, then the doctor may very well say, I no longer think that food and water is beneficial as a medical treatment, and therefore I'm not under any obligation to supply it. When in reality, as you point out, it is basic care. And the fact that it may be done in a hospital does not change the fact that it's basic care that every person is entitled to because of their true human dignity.
Mm-hmm. So then moving forth from there, then we don't have a lot of time, but one of the things I just want to throw out for people to consider is the reality of palliative care and hospice, and how we have an obligation to discern these things in light of church teachings. Now, Bruce, we really have hit the end of the segment, but I want to thank you for joining us and thank you for writing this book. The book is Now and at the Hour of Our Death, Making Moral Decisions at the End of Life. This is published by Ignatius Press, and the authors are Nicholas Nickus and my guest here, Bruce Green. Bruce is the co-author of Now and at the Hour of Our Death, former constitutional law professor, and he serves as special counsel to the Bioethics Defense Fund. Stay tuned as we wrap up this hour. I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the Afternoon.
Living the Beatitudes with Father Bjorn.
Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. We get what we look for. St. Thérèse of Lisieux has an interesting insight on this. Once in a discussion over the possibility of avoiding purgatory, the future saint told another member of her community, Sister Maria Fabronia, that God was more father than judge. And in this discussion, debate, she finally took the liberty of saying to the other sister, "If you look for the justice of God, you will get it. The soul will receive from God exactly what she desires." Are we full of wounds and anger and hurt, and do we want to inflict that on other people? Are we allowing God to heal us? If we receive His mercy, we have to show it to others. The Beatitudes are the heart of Jesus' message. Let's be transformed by them. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy.
For more about the Beatitudes, visit EWTNRC.com.
The Catholic Church teaches that Jesus Christ is literally and wholly present, body and blood, soul and divinity, under the appearances of bread and wine. St. John the Apostle records the John chapter 6 Bread of Life discourse, in which Jesus states that his flesh is true food and his blood true drink. Who better to understand John's writings and subsequent teachings than a disciple and student of John, St. Ignatius of Antioch? In his letter to the Smyrnians in 110 AD, Ignatius writes, "I have no taste for corruptible food, nor for the pleasures of this life. I desire the bread of God, which is the flesh of Jesus Christ. And for drink, I desire his blood, which is love incorruptible." The Catholic Church absolutely follows St. John and St. Ignatius in taking Jesus at his word. Examining the truths of the Catholic faith, this is faithforensics.org.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. The USCCB reminds us that for the Christian, our encounter with suffering and with death can only take on a positive and distinctive meaning when we see it, when we view them, through the redemptive power of Jesus' suffering and death. Which means that while this truth doesn't take away necessarily our fear and the pain that we undergo, it does give us a confidence and a grace for undergoing that suffering and even death that triumphs over even the trepidation of that suffering and death. So instead of wallowing in despair, spiraling out of control in being overwhelmed by it, the Catholic faith provides us with an eternal hope that gives us an assurance that's greater than even the sting of fear, sin, and death. And that is our hope. That is the joy that we have. Until next time, I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the Afternoon.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.